This is Neil Adams, and you've reached the higher level of Nerdvana.
Ladies and gentlemen, trees and multiforms, welcome to the podcast.
Robo fucking cop.
As far as I'm concerned, Bruce Willis can go get a bag of dicks. Get off my shit.
ConfessionsOfAMovieSnob.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, trees and multiforms, welcome to the podcast. I am Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
With me is who?
I'm Ethan.
And he, yeah, always interrupting Ethan.
I'm trying.
Getting angry, barking at dogs. So, I'm getting angry at barking dogs. But this is a weekly podcast.
For a second, I thought you said you were getting angry barking at dogs.
I probably did. I'm so frustrated with these fucking skunk-smelling dogs right now. They're just making me mad. But one of the things that I do when I do get mad is I make a podcast every week. It's kind of my release, and this is that podcast. And what we typically do is we typically just take some sliver of movies, some sort of movie talk, and we just talk about it, be it movie genres, movie posters, character deaths, just stuff like that. And tonight we're going to actually continue. We've had a break for a while, but continue on an ongoing series that we started back in, I want to say, November, December. Mm-hmm. But we are continuing our decades discussion. Tonight we're going to be tackling the 1960s in film. First decade that we were not alive in any stretch of the imagination. I mean, there's a little bit of a stretch last time where we're all like, yeah, motherfucker, I was alive for 6 days in this decade, so I know what's going on. But
exactly.
No, this one's around for like a whole decade before we were even born.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, should be an interesting decade to talk about. So we'll have to see what happens. And I did learn it is kind of an interesting decade. So I guess we'll just talk about that when we get to that point of the show. But before we get into any of that, we do have a little segment called Geekly Happenings where we talk about news relevant to us geeks. But I think it's kind of devolved into we talk about movie trailers and people who died, which is pretty much what it seems to be lately, because that's about the only thing we notice anymore is like,
yeah.
Holy crap, oh my God, somebody died, or oh my God, there's a movie trailer. And it's going to be the former in this case, because tonight we're going to be talking about the release of the Thor. Well, it's not even called Thor 2 Into Dark, or it's not even Art Into Darkness, that's Star Trek.
Yeah.
Thor the Dark World, the sequel to the 2011, you know, Marvel film, obviously starring, you know, Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston, Natalie Portman. Fill in the blank, all those people. It was a Marvel movie that that grew on me a lot. Last time we talked Marvel movies with Ed Douglas, I think it ended up topping both his and my list. We just liked the movie so much, and so we have a trailer now, and this is one you've seen, correct, Ethan?
Yes, it is.
And what were your thoughts or your impressions?
I think it looks like Thor 2. It's I'm interested to see what the director does with it, because it's I believe this director hasn't done a feature film before. He's directed TV, like but he's directed things like the several Game of Thrones episodes and several episodes of Rome. So, I mean, those are two shows I really enjoy. So, I'm interested to see what they do with it. And this one's got Christopher Eccleston as the bad guy, Malekith.
And heavy makeup, but
yes.
It is the amount of under there. I mean, kind of like how Colm Feore played Laufey in the first one, and nobody knew it until after the movie.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's probably going to be the same deal here, but man, Christopher Eccleston's a fucking good actor, and he's a pretty goddamn good villain, too, so should be good to see. I don't know, my impressions from the movie, from the trailer so far, are, you know, looks like Jane Foster is going to be going to Asgard with Thor. Mm-hmm. But what sucks is it looks like she's leaving behind Stellan Skarsgård and Kat Dennings, which blow. Because like, it was one of the things that I said about the first one was, you know, I'm pretty infamously not a Natalie Portman fan. I kind of can't stand the bitch. But in the first movie, you know, I had all the Natalie Portman crappiness, but at least I could offset it with, you know, Stellan Skarsgård and Kat Dennings, which both, you know, kicked all kinds of ass. And
yeah.
Hopefully I'm going to have something like that going on here, but I don't know. We have that going on, and
I'm curious to see how much of the movie is actually in Asgard, or if how much of it actually is going to take place on Earth. It seems just from the trailer that a little bit takes place on Earth, and then the rest of it is just in on Asgard. So,
kind of the flip side of the first one.
Yeah,
yeah, because the first one there's a little bit in Asgard, most of it took place on Earth, and yeah, I guess that's fair. But I do know that in the first one, I liked I kind of dug the Earth stuff better than the. And don't get me wrong, I loved looking at the Asgard stuff. It was beautiful. I mean, it was very reminiscent of all the badass Jack Kirby drawings and stuff like that. And obviously, it was visually awesome. But I kind of just enjoyed the story more on Earth. It was, you know, maybe a bit more grounded. I kind of dug Thor running around in jeans and a t-shirt versus, you know, the Thor suit. But, you know, I don't know. But I enjoy the character. I think that, you know, Hemsworth has done a good job of, you know, earning our trust to where we can say, like, I don't like Natalie Portman. I'd like it more of it to be on Earth. Are they really going to ring that Loki bell again? And it's like, well, you know what? Fuck it, because I've liked everything they've done so far. So maybe my instincts are wrong here. Could be good. Should be good, though. I know that everybody is just thrilled to death of Tom Hiddleston returning as Loki, and you got to see a fun little, I don't even know what you call it, a flourish at the end of the trailer where they show him in his gel cell and getting let out, and, you know, looks like it's going to be Loki and Thor versus Malekith, and should be fucking awesome.
And we're all going to wait to see how he gets away, or how Loki decides to screw things up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure he's going to be like, okay, now that I've helped you, let's go back to my jail cell, because that just sounds like the trickster god to me.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, wait. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. But it should be good. I'm actually super looking forward to this one. Super looking forward to this one. It's coming out in November, is that correct?
Yeah, November, like November 3rd. It's early November.
Ah, yep.
Okay, I think it's planning on steering clear of. It's planning on steering clear of the Hunger Games sequel.
When's that coming out?
That's Thanksgiving.
Oh, well. Yeah, okay. No, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they don't want the brothers Hemsworth to be competing at the box office, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Let's see what happens. A little bit more news. It's going to be comic book movie news related. That's just kind of what ended up happening this week, and it's what we kind of pay attention to. Another little bit is... We do have word from the head of Marvel Studios that the rights for Daredevil have indeed reverted back to Marvel Studios from Fox. Well, wait a minute. It was Fox. Yeah, Fox had that one. And obviously, I think we just kind of have a blanket happiness about anything reverting back to Marvel Studios at this point. You know, although, like, you know, the Daredevil movie was what it was, but I didn't think it was that goddamn awful. I know that everyone was just, when it came out, everyone was just all, you know, boo, horrible. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's not that bad. But I don't know. Should be good, though. I mean, it's reverting back to Marvel Studios. And, I mean, is there going to be any of that stuff going on where they need to make a movie before it reverts somewhere else? Or is it just reverts back to the originators? I don't really understand how that works.
It reverts back to the originators. It's the rights are... still held by Marvel, and obviously now it's Marvel's not going to license it out to a different studio at this point. So,
right.
Yeah.
Then again, they got back the Punisher and didn't do shit with it, and that was easily over a year ago. But, you know, maybe that's all they want is they just want to have these properties and sit on it so they can do them proper. Instead
well, they,
of,
you know, I could see him doing more with I could see him doing more with Daredevil because he is a part. He was a part of the Avengers,
right.
But with that leaves the X-Men characters, really the X-Men universe, Spider-Man and Ghost Rider, I think, are the one Fantastic Four are the ones that they don't have the rights to right now.
I'm really surprised Fantastic Four hasn't reverted back yet. Yeah. That strikes. I mean, at all. I mean, obviously, I think that Marvel is probably, you know, really drooling to get like Spider-Man back, but I want to see them get Fantastic Four back. I think they could do some really cool shit with the Fantastic Four, especially in Phase 2 and 3 of the Marvel Universe. I mean, there could be some really neat stuff going on there. And granted, I know they want Spider-Man and X-Men back, but, you know, that's the one that, like, you know, me as a fan, me as somebody that, you know, actually just wants to see this stuff, would like to see versus, you know, being a, you know, a, I don't know, a stockholder with an over-under option. But should be good. good. So hopefully they do something good with it. Hopefully they don't just sit on it, because, you know, Daredevil's an interesting character. I like the first one for what it was. I mean, sure. I didn't expect it to change the world, but, you know, I spent 90 minutes of my time watching it, and I could have done worse things with it.
True.
So this could be good. Should be good. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was a weird little news beat that I found that was actually sent to me by my co-host of the Truthful Comics podcast, Corey. It was in an interview that Zack Snyder revealed that if the Man of Steel film is a success, then he will be offered the job of directing the Justice League movie for Warner Brothers. And I kind of got into a typical nerd argument with the three of them, because I don't know, rather the two of them, because they seem to think that, you know, I'm just all like, you know, fuck Zack Snyder in the ass, and I'm not quite there. You know, I'm just like, I'm very Zack Snyder neutral, I feel. I mean, like, I've liked some of his movies, I haven't liked some of his other movies. Man of Steel looks like it's shaping up to be pretty good, but I don't want to see the same person who directed Superman to direct Justice League. I think that they're two completely different kinds of movies with two completely different kinds of sensibilities.
Yeah.
I think the Superman movie needs to be, I think it needs to be intimate, honestly. I think it needs to be, you know, a story about, you know, Superman, you know, coming into his own as a, you know, a citizen of Earth versus versus a Kryptonian and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, don't get me wrong, I do want to see him punch shit. I want to see him punch shit. And when you get the Justice League movie, when you start bringing in some of these other characters, be it Superman, Batman, Flash, Wonder Woman, etc., that's when they need to turn on the epic. They need to really turn the epic hose on. And I think that, you know, that's going to need to be the big over-the-top, you know, like crazy kinetic action movie. And I don't know that Zack Snyder has proven to me that he can handle both of those kinds of movies. I mean, he does obviously have a very distinct style. You know, whether he's an idiot fanboy like McGee seems to think, or I'm sorry, idiot man-child, yeah, like McGee seems to think, or, you know, he's just, you know, he's a capable director, is kind of irrelevant to me. I just want to see somebody different direct Justice League than Man of Steel, personally.
I mean, they need someone who can handle an ensemble well, especially if that ensemble is including, you know, like Superman, Batman, and Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, all that stuff. Is you need someone who has good experience working with a lot of characters and giving them all a good amount of time that they need. And I don't think Scott Snyder really does that. I mean, yes, he did Watchmen, but, you know, Watchmen was what it was, but it's definitely not Justice League.
No.
So, I don't know. I mean, that sort of begs the question of who would you have direct a Justice League movie, because I think a Justice League movie really would be different than the Avengers movie, because it's just two different flavors, you know, two different circumstances. But I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I don't know, because a lot of people seem to think that they are grooming Zack Snyder to do the Joss Whedon thing in the DCU, mm-hmm. and Christ, I hate that idea. I really don't like that idea. And again, you know, I don't want to be perceived as a Snyder hater, because I'm not. You know, I'm pretty much neutral to him, but I just cannot see him handling something like this. I mean, granted, he's proven in his career that he is capable of handling, you know, franchises that don't belong to him. But I kind of wonder if he would be any good at, you know, juggling several balls all at once.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. To me, I want to see a more experienced director. And I actually kind of, you know, stuck my fucking foot in my mouth we were talking about this, you know, before this news even came out, because one of those guys, you know, suggesting, you know, well, maybe Zack Snyder can do what Joss Whedon is doing. And I'm like, boo, no way. Like, I said he's way too young way too inexperienced to, you know, do this. And I said, you know, the dude's got to be, what, early 40s? I looked it up. He's like 49. I had no idea he was that old.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea. I would have figured that he was, you know, at most early 40s, at most. But he's like almost 50, and kind of surprised about that, honestly, because his movies do not seem like they would come from a 50-year-old. But,
yeah.
I don't know. Let's see what happens. I mean, obviously, I haven't written off anything at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. You know, it's hard to really judge until we see Superman, so we see Man of Steel, mm-hmm. honestly. It's, you know, mm-hmm. we've seen Snyder's other stuff, and it's hit and miss. Yep. But, you know, and none of it is stuff that I would say, yes, Superman. Or yes, Justice League. Yeah. You know, stuff that's like, he does good. He does some entertaining stuff. He's hit some home runs. He's hit some awful foul balls. I really like 300, but...
I like 300 just fine, but I couldn't call it a fucking home run. I mean, maybe a base hit.
To each their own.
I really like 300, but I mean, I don't... There's nothing about that where I'm like, okay, this is the next fucking... is the next Hitchcock.
He certainly doesn't have the fan cred that someone like Joss Whedon has or someone like J.J. Abrams has, you know, something like that. Yeah. But J.J. Abrams is obviously Mr. Science Fiction at this point. I mean, he's Star Trek, Star Wars, but they need... Because, I mean, really, you want to think of someone to take that role. You got Joss Whedon, you got J.J. Abrams... Then who, you know, and it's just hard to sort of think of someone that someone who's entrenched in the movie industry that's big enough nerd, big enough geek to tackle that. That, you know, it's like, and Zack Snyder isn't a name that comes to mind.
Not for me either, but at the same time, I do feel kind of shitty for not having a solution. He just doesn't sound right.
Yeah,
and you know, I'm not going to accept Zack Snyder because I don't have a better answer. You know, this isn't like, oh crap, they're out of Coke. I'll get Pepsi. I mean, this is not this is a Justice League movie, and this could really make or break the DC cinematic universe. And so I think that they really need to think about what they're doing here. I mean, for the love of God, I mean, like, Ben Affleck isn't a bad idea. You know, it was coming out when they first announced that, Justice League was happening, and I think he immediately shot it down. But you know, like somebody like that, I wouldn't mind. You know, somebody that, you know, like that has kind of like that old school sensibility when it comes to, you know, making a film. But you know, they're obviously very technically professional. I don't know. I don't have an answer. I'd have to think more about it. The only thing I know, Zack Snyder just doesn't, you know, ring right to me, honestly. And
yeah.
I could be wrong. I mean, maybe Man of Steel comes out and it'll be the greatest thing ever, and he'll make Justice League, and it'll make, you know, twice the money of Titanic on opening day. I mean, who knows what the hell is going to happen? But yeah, something we'll about see. It doesn't immediately jump out to me. So we gotta see what happens there as well. Okay. Other than that, do we have any other geekly happenings, Ethan? No. I can't recall anything. No. Nothing news wise.
No.
I kind of want to beat around the bush with the whole Iron Man thing. Or Iron Man 3 without giving it away, but I can't fucking wait. I cannot wait for the nerd rage on that one. Oh my God, it's going to be delicious. It's going to make the Phantom Menace seem like nothing after that movie comes out. I can't wait. It's going to rule. I mean, I'm calling it right now. I'm calling 2013 the summer of the butthurt fanboy. I mean, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. It's... Some people are. I've talked to some people that, and I'm not giving it away, and I'm not giving it away on the podcast. I'm not going to give it away to Ethan, but that spoiler is something that I do know. Some people that I know some people that have figured out what it is and what's going to happen in this movie, and they are fucking livid. You know, they like, you know, they're acting like they got their mothers raped or something. It's awesome how mad these people are getting.
We'll certainly know by our next episode we record, so
yeah, should be great. You know, me, I know what it is, and I can don't care. You know, which is something that happens to me a lot. Everyone's all like, fucking boo. I'm like, I don't care. But you know, to me, I keep on saying that a good movie is obviously always going to be number one priority to me. You know, when I go see one of these comic book movies, but any more like righteous indignation from idiot fanboys is such a nice second place for me because you know, great movies come out all the time, but it's just kind of funny to see people get all bent out of shape about something that doesn't matter at all. So should be good. But before I give away too much. Why don't we just move right on into the main topic discussion, and we're going to continue our ongoing discussion about the films of over the past 100 years, and we're tackling this decade by decade, and tonight we're going to be talking about the 1960s in film. Now, Ethan, the 1960s is like we said in the intro here. It's going to be the first decade that we're going to be talking about here that we didn't live through, and you know, everything that we have to say about it's going to be stuff that we've read, or you know, our own little impressions that we picked up, you know, by watching other people's impressions of it, and so on and so forth. To me, this has been always been, you know, from day one, you know, from when we decided we were going to continue to do this. This is the decade I've been dreading the most, and not because I'm all like, you know, fuck the '60s. It's just that, like, to me, there is clearly, you know, there's clearly like 1990s movies, 80s movies, 70s movies,
fair,
50s movies, 40s movies, but 60s, it doesn't smack to me that way. I mean, it just, for whatever reason, something about the films of the 1960s. It was a very transitional period of time.
I was going to say, the 60s, sort of was looking at the movies that came out from 1960 to 1969, is you pretty much had a, you know, 10-year period of transition from the 50s to the 70s, of, you know, of the sort of lighthearted 50s movies into the very hard-edged 70s movies, and there's a mix of the two in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, there's the Hayes Code finally went away in, like, God, I want to say 63, 64. Mm-hmm. And so, like, a lot of really strange-ass experimental cinema started coming out. And so, you know, we kind of have that angle. But it's also funny that, like, you know, I say, you know, oh, I was dreading this, and, oh, nothing jumps out at me. But it's also a very important decade, because there's so much stuff that happened in this decade that really shaped cinema as it is today, that shaped movies that we're going to see in the theater. I mean, good God, like, sci-fi was just gigantic. I mean, there's some huge sci-fi things that happened here. Comedy got a lot more sophisticated, I guess, you know, for lack of a better term. You know, we had a nice revitalization of, like, the sword and sandal epics. We had something. We had a nice revitalization of the frickin' Western. We saw the birth of spaghetti Western. We saw the first ever James Bond movie. We saw some really crazy shit happen in this decade, and it was it's exactly like you're saying when we were leading into this that. You know, 1970s. We think, okay, yeah, we had the rise of the anti-hero and, you know, the anti-government stuff. 1980s, you know, over-the-top action. You know, 1950s is going to be the post-war movies. And this one doesn't really nail down like that, but it has a little bit of everything. And I did find it, you know, once I got looking at it and really got thinking about it, this is kind of an interesting decade for film. It'd be a really good one to, like, take some sort of class on and study it in depth, because there's a lot happened. And it's hard to say, you know, one defining moment, you know, film-wise, for me. I mean, do you see it, Ethan? Do you see something like that?
There are definitely some milestones in the '60s that happened, cinema, you know, film-wise, and obviously historically, there's a lot of unrest and a lot of social change that went on in the 1960s, and that's very evident in the movies. Where if you look at the movies that came out in 1960 versus the movies that came out in 1969. You have a very, and you said it, you know, the code going out in about 1964, so sort of about in the middle of the decade, you know, things drastically changed, and so there really wasn't any, point in the 1960s where there was a very galvanized, this is what the 1960s is with film. I mean,
There's no Star Wars that came out in 19.
Exactly. I mean, there's James Bond, obviously, and that was that's a huge thing. That is born from that, and sort of that's the birth of that sort of James Bond spy genre. But beyond that, we started getting things that became much bigger in the 70s, and then we saw the death of a lot of things that were big in the 50s. And so you know, I think with the code going away and really the way the economy was going and everything, you saw the advent of a lot of cheaper films. So, I mean, you saw a lot of Roger Corman and Hammer Horror stuff that started coming out in the 60s. And so it was kind of interesting, at least in that light. But there are, obviously, in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, you have big milestone films. You have to go, oh, Star Wars, you know, Godfather, Terminator 2, all that, you know, Terminator, you know, all those movies that have come out. And even in the 1950s, you have some of those. But in the 1960s, there isn't one that was just the movie people talked about. You know, it's like, this is the movie that just knocked it dead. There's no Gone with the Wind. You know, I mean, there's this is a definitive movie of from that time period. There just isn't one. So I found it kind of very challenging to come up with a list.
You know, to me, a list was, you know, wasn't that difficult to come up with, but it was just like, what the fuck am I going to do with this? Because it's like, there was, you know, just a wide variety of things. And there's certainly none of those like tentpole movies, you know, Aaron tentpole movies, like, oh, The Empire Strikes Back. Well, shit, we know that's a number one. And there's none of those for me. I mean, there's certainly movies that came out in this time period that I'm fond of, but like none of them that I would consider like amongst my favorite films of all time. And it's just kind of interesting because I had no problems coming up with a list, but it just like, you know, I like, you know, how do I say if I like, you know, this movie better than this movie when they're two completely different movies? And it's an interesting thing. I think we just kind of got to get started on this because, you know, we're having to spend a lot of time beating around the bush to explain what we mean by this. So why don't we just get moving on this list and talk about, you know, our impressions of the films from the 1960s.
Sure.
Well, what's your number six, Ethan?
I'll jump right on in with the number six. It's the iconic, what we already mentioned, it's Goldfinger. It's the third James Bond movie that sort of set the standard for all of the James Bond movies for the next 30 years. Was you had, you know, obviously James Bond, pretty girls, gadgets, and cars. And there you go. That was the formula for the next 30 years. And this movie set that stage. It's the Bond villains with good old Harold Sakata, his odd job. You know, you have the crazy henchmen. And, you know, Goldfinger obviously is still one of my absolute favorites. It's definitely entrenched in the 60s movies. It's came out in 1964. It's a movie that really defined that sort of spy genre. Cause I mean, this, you know, James Bond was doing exceptionally well, and this one came out and just created the James Bond formula, and it influenced other movies coming out, you know, like in like Flint and, you know, movies like that that just kept coming out as time progressed that were just obviously influenced by James Bond and by Goldfinger. And we've talked James Bond movies in like many, 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 many times. Had a whole show on it way back in
twice.
Red Phone Zone times.
No, we've done it twice.
Oh, have we done it twice now?
We've done it twice. We did it was on issue number 007 in Red Phone Zone times. But we also went back over them with, I want to say, Matt Forbeck. You know, like back, way back.
Yes,
in, like,
the James Bond genre.
Early confessions. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
James Bond genre. So, I mean, it ended up at number six on my list. It is definitely one of my absolute favorites. It's definitely my favorite Sean Connery Bond movie. It's no longer my favorite Bond movie, but it is absolutely fantastic. And, you know, no one can deny the influence that this had on, really, on movies. So, James Bond, Goldfinger.
No. And you also can't really deny the influence. I didn't pick this one for my list, but I did pick From Russia with Love. I think it's 1963. 1963. It's just one that I like better. I mean, it's before the whole gadget thing happened, and you know, all that kind of stuff. I went with that one, so you know, I had to get a James Bond movie in here because you can't really underestimate what Bond did do for the 60s. But you know, they also say that they say that there's the three B's of the 60s, and they are the Beatles, they are Bond, and they are Batman. So I went with the 1966 Batman movie for my number six. Now, granted, you know, maybe in terms of, you know, a dark, brooding Batman movie, you know, like Frank Miller shit and all that stuff that we have going on, and, you know, comic book movies, in this really rich comic book movie world that we live in, maybe it isn't that great, but I say fuck all that, because I really like the Adam West, and you know what, I like the movie, don't get me wrong, but when I say the 1966, you know, Batman the movie, I'm more or less talking the series.
Sure.
But, you know, in terms of the movie, I like the movie a lot, too. I like the series. I like what it, you know, I kind of like, I just kind of like what it did for Batman. I mean, not that it
Well, especially again, at the time, you know, at the time, the comic was not doing well, and the series came out and just totally revitalized it and rejuvenated it and changed everything, you know.
Well, I guess it even changed the way that we looked at, you know, modern television. Well, that television time, because, you know, it was like, it was a stupid-ass expensive show to produce, too.
Yeah.
You know, because they had all those costumes and all those sets and all those, you know, like the guest stars and stuff like that. And it was like stupid-ass expensive to produce. I want to say that the television show only lasted 2.5 or 3.5 seasons, something like that. And it's because it costs too fucking much. They're like, you know what, people are watching this. You know, people are really digging this, but I can't do this shit. It's just all like, you know, it was too bad because this is a fun one. I mean, I always enjoyed the lighthearted take on Batman. I think Adam West is, I thought Adam West is a great Batman, one of my favorite Batman. And, you know, there's great stuff in this movie. You know, the shark repellent bat spray always comes to mind. Some days we can't get rid of a bomb comes to mind.
And yeah.
It's just an overall fun, good movie. So I picked it for my number 6.
It is a fun one, and it didn't make my list, but it's one I look back on very fondly. I used to watch it when I was a kid, so, you know, it's one of those that just doesn't, you don't really realize, especially when you're growing up, it's probably one of the things that your parents are watching you go, that's like, I watched this when I was a kid, and he's watching it too. That's kind of fun, you know, and it's not something you really think about.
Yep, I guess so. I mean, it's fun, though. It's fun.
It is.
Moving on. What's your number 5, Ethan?
All right, my number 5 is a movie that I doubt you've seen or probably even heard of. It's a movie I was first exposed to about 15 years ago at a film festival here in Kansas City. And it's a Japanese movie called Goyokin, which is also known as the Steel Edge of Revenge is one of its titles here. It is a samurai movie, but it is not done by Akira Kurosawa. It is done by a director named Hideo Gosha. And it stars Tatsuya Nakadai, who people will recognize from the later Kurosawa works like Ron and Kagemusha, the Shadow Warrior. He was a big star. And essentially what it's about a set in Tokugawa Japan and Tokugawa era feudal Japan, and the a ship carrying gold wrecks off of this near this fishing village on the north in the northern part of Japan, and the peasants all get the gold in, and then the local magistrate, this local magistrate, basically kills all of the peasants and steals the gold. And the samurai that was with him, this guy who's played by Tatsuya Nakadai, obviously didn't approve, but this was his master, and so he said, you can't do this again. If you do this again, I'll have to stop you. And he goes on his merry way, and years and years pass, and the guy sends killers to kill the guy, and the guy figures out that this dude's gonna try doing it again. So essentially it comes down to he gets this sort of group together, and they go out to the frigid north of in Japan, and they have this big battle in the middle of the snow, and it being, you know, made in the 1960s, this is real snow, and this is they're obviously really having this fight. It's a very cool movie. I really enjoyed it. The first time I saw it was on the big screen, and I had to wait probably about 10 years before I could see it again when it finally came out on DVD here. So it's a really good movie. It's called Goyokin. Really cool.
Goyokin. Mm-hmm. What's the American subtitle of that?
One of the American titles is The Steel Edge of Revenge.
Okay, you say one. What are there several?
It's one of those that's been released in different under different titles here and there. That's the one I know of. It is available on DVD as just Goyokin.
Okay. Is this one that you have? This it's interesting.
Yeah, I've got it. I've got it on DVD. Oh, cool. It's not on Blu-ray, unfortunately. But
that doesn't particularly surprise me.
Yeah, but it is quite good. I really like the movie. It's very cool. It ends with a big samurai duel in the middle of a big snowfield. It's very neat.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, at this point, moving on to my number 5. My number 5 is one that I'm honestly surprised that maybe isn't higher on my list, and I would probably say the only reason it isn't higher on my list is because I felt it was kind of, I don't know, maybe predictable from me, because, you know, I'm the guy that, you know, loves his, you know, my black and white, over-the-top fucking dramas. You know, I love them. So I went with the 1961 Judgment at Nuremberg, starring Spencer Tracy, Burt Lancaster, with a fucking awesome Oscar-winning role by Maximilian Schell. This is one of those movies that I think that every damn, you know, court procedural wants to be this movie.
Yeah.
You know, I think that every single movie that tries to make some sort of historical statement wants to be this movie. I mean, I think every movie that, you know, that gets some sort of movie star says, damn it, I wish we just had Spencer Tracy and Burt Lancaster, you know, like they did and this is just such a remarkable movie. It almost seems like it's bragging. I mean, it's long as hell. I mean, and you have just fucking living gods at the time with those people, with Spencer Tracy, with Maximilian. Well, I'm sorry, with Spencer Tracy and Burt Lancaster and et cetera. But, you know, it's kind of fun that, you know, it was Maximilian Schell that, like, walked away with the Oscar, even though he so deserved it. It's one of those movies that has, like, one of those amazing-ass, you know, closing statement scenes. And it's what's even more amazing about it is, you know, the Nazi side, you know, kind of makes their point a little bit better. And it's kind of fucked up. And, you know, there's also the whole thing where, you know, obviously Spencer Tracy's playing the judge. He's like, you know what, you're right, but I don't care. It's just basically what happened. And obviously this is a historical thing, and, you know, his judgment was overturned and all that stuff. But it is such a remarkably good movie. This is one of those movies that, it's one of those ones I'll recommend to somebody. Like, okay, I actually want to start taking movies seriously. So far I've seen Transformers and, you know, The Lion King. You know, what other great movies like that are there? I'm like, shut the fuck up and watch this movie. Then we'll talk great cinema. So I picked up my number 5. Great one. Really, really great one. You've seen this one, right, Ethan?
I have not actually seen that one.
Oh, wow. You would love this movie then. You would love this movie so much.
That's what I've been told. I understand it's really, really good. It was came recommended out of my legal ethics class, so...
Oh, God, yeah.
So I really want to see it.
Yeah, I mean, if we ever end up doing a court procedural, this will certainly be on my list. It's a really good one. Really
nice.
Good movie. All right, moving on. What's your number 4?
I'm just getting my samurai movies out of the way. My number 4 is one of my absolute favorite Kurosawa films. It's Yojimbo, starring Toshirô Mifune.
It's my number 10.
It is an absolutely great movie, and it spawned so many remakes, and you know, definitely was that the one of the epitomes of the Eastern, you know, that created the whole Western thing. Because we had the whole Fistful of Dollars coming out in a few years after this, with Clint Eastwood in the title role, and you had this great movie with this great character in Mifune. This is the samurai with no name. He's Yojimbo, which is masterless, this little masterless samurai wandering about. And spawned many, many clones and sort of remakes and all that. And it's a great movie. It has Tatsuya Nakadai in it, and it introduces this gun, who brings a gun into the whole mix in the feudal Japan. And it's very much a movie that's an allegory about the death of the samurai and the death of the old the way of Bushido and all that. It's a great movie. You watch it, and you obviously more people have seen Fistful of Dollars, and so they see this and go, hey, this is just like Fistful of Dollars. And, you know, honestly, it's like, well, yeah, dumbass. exactly. And it was influential in making a ton of other things, like the Bruce Willis Who Can Eat a Bag of Dicks in Last Man Standing in 1996. Lucky Number 7 and Sukiyaki Western Django. So a lot of movies that have been influenced by it. It's a great movie. It's really cool, really action packed. It's got a lot of really cool, you know, what you would go on to attribute to Clint Eastwood with the whole, you know, I'm a badass, and, you know, you're going to need 3 coffins or 4 coffins. And this guy, Toshirô Mifune's character, just comes out and, you know, kicks everyone's ass. It's great.
Yep. It's a good one. I put him at number 10 because I knew that it was a physical impossibility for you to make this list and not have that one in there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? You know, I might give Ethan some shit about, you know, I'm going to take back Unforgiven from him, but I'm not even going to attempt to take Kurosawa from you because that would be an exercise in futility and quite frankly stupid and kind of mean of me. So I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna do that. But yeah, I guess moving on to my number four. My number four is one that I guess if you're familiar with the 1960s at all and you're familiar with me at all, you're wondering when this shit was going to start to happen, especially when we're counting down decades. You wonder when I was going to run into a specific director. Said director would be Mr. Charles Chaplin. I picked the 1967 Countess from Hong Kong, starring Marlon Brando, Sophia Loren, Sidley Chaplin's in it, Tippi Hedren. This is a movie that it kind of cracks me the hell up because people are all like, Countess of Hong Kong, boo, that's Charlie Chaplin's worst movie. I'm like, yeah, it's Charlie Chaplin's worst movie, but Charlie Chaplin's worst is better than almost everybody's best. And to be fair, I will completely agree that it's his worst movie. And, you know, he's showing his age and he's maybe losing some of his vitality and stuff like that. Because, you know, he's not particular. I mean, he's in it, don't get me wrong, but he's not, like, playing the tramp or some kind of character like that. But, you know, he's more behind the scenes, and, you know, he had a famously awful time working with Marlon Brando. Imagine those two.
No, yeah, I can only imagine that.
Egos on set together. You know, young, vital Brandon and Brando and old established Chaplin. I mean, they just had a famously awful time on set. Sophia Loren, you know, from that point forward, refused to ever work with Brando again because I guess he was a real prick. Overall, it's a good movie, and it's still fun to see an old master at work like that, especially in his prime. This is his final movie that he directed, and you know, I had to get on my list. So 1967 Countess from Hong Kong.
I've never seen it, so
I wouldn't figure. I wouldn't figure.
I will have to check it out at some point.
Mm-hmm. It's good. You need to watch everything Charlie Chaplin ever had anything to do with. It'll make you a better person.
I could see that.
It'll make you a better person. So, yep. Okay. Moving on. What's your number? Three.
My number three. I'm getting animated. That's right. I'm getting animated. It's the 1963 Disney film, The Sword and the Stone.
There we go.
I love this movie. This is I remember watching this when I was a kid and just falling in love with it. You know, you always go back to that mage, that wizard's duel between Merlin and the witch and all the shape-shifting and everything. And, you know, you just had some great, fun, awesome moments in this movie. And it's just one of those movies that just really sings and it's great. It's not... It's not what you would take to be a Disney movie nowadays, obviously, as Disney does different types of things. But this one is just a great classic. It's sword and sorcery done just wonderfully, and Merlin and Archimedes and all that. It's awesome. It's The Sword and the Stone. If you haven't seen it, you've been living under a rock for your whole life. So
yeah, there's some great stuff in it. Yeah, I like it. Not on my list. I actually don't have any Disney movies on here, although there are several that would be, you know, entirely appropriate to have on this list, but I didn't happen to have them on here. So, All right, moving on to my number three. My number three is one that I imagine is somewhere on Ethan's list. I don't really know where, but I imagine it's got to be on there somewhere. But it is the Hitchcock flick Psycho, 1960. We've talked about this movie a lot. This is the and for those of you unfamiliar, this is the shot for shot unmake of Gus Van Sant's version or whatever. But yeah, this is the original. This is the one that started it all. This is the one that kind of gave birth to the slasher flick in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, the slasher flick is kind of its Down syndrome offspring. But this is a very smart, very crazy movie. It's one of those ones that had a lot of fun with the sensationalism of a film of its movie stars. You know, by casting Janet Leigh and then killing her ass. What is it, 42 minutes into the movie and like switching your leads? I mean,
yeah.
Talked about this movie so much, I'd hate to repeat myself, but I love this movie. It's my number three. I mean, what do you got to say about it, Ethan?
It's my number seven. It's a great movie. It's not my favorite Hitchcock movie, but it is fantastic. So you have a master like Hitchcock doing this low budget black and white, basically a slasher film, and he shows you how it's done. You know, it's a memorable movie with you know, something that you could go back and go, well, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, you know, this is where you get it all from. This is how you do a twist. You know, this is great. Mm-hmm. And yeah, killing the main actress and sort of leaving you with Norman Bates pretty much after that point and going, well, now what?
Yep.
You know, I remember when you first see this movie and you're old enough to really realize it, you get halfway through and you're the person you've been following is now dead, and you're literally like, well, now what? the movie can't be over. Who we follow now? And it's a great movie.
I brought it up before. I'm gonna bring it up again because it's just, you know, turned into like one of my favorite fucking stories of all time. I was showing Rachel all the Hitchcock movies, and mm-hmm. we were watching this one, and we got about, you know, 45 minutes into this movie, and she's like, "Ah!" I'm like, "What?" She's like, "Why does everyone like this?" I'm like, "What? Because it's fucking awesome." She's like, "Well, you know, it's not very realistic." I'm like, "Realistic?" She's like, "Yeah, yeah. You know, how would that frail old woman kill all these people and, you know, do all that?" And I'm just thinking, like, I guess you have a point. In my head, I'm thinking, you know, just like what she's gonna be walking into. And it was really neat to see her, you know, figure that out. And, you know, I don't know how in the hell she lived to be 26 years old and not know that twist, but, you know, that I would have loved to have actually, you know, like, you know, obviously, you know, being a movie guy, you know, I probably learned about this reading it, or, you know, or, you know, revealed to me in some other movie or something else. It would have been badass to actually experience this, you know, as it was meant to, and find out, like, oh my God, it was Norman? Holy crap. And
yeah,
it was awesome. I loved it. It's my number three, easy. It's a good flick, very representative of the 1960s.
It's a great movie, and it's a great movie. And we talked about how the 60s was this big, giant transitional period, and you mentioned how Westerns really came into, you know, came back, and really did some evolving in the 1960s and into the 70s. My number two is The Wild Bunch. Obviously, you know, it's one of my absolute favorites.
There's the obvious one for your list.
Yes.
When's the bringing up The Wild Bunch? Left off my list, I knew you wouldn't do it without it.
Yeah, you know it's coming. You know it's on my list somewhere. It's number two. It's The Wild Bunch. It is came out in the late 60s. Was very much a predecessor or a sign of things to come with the 1970s, is you had this a very violent cathartic type of movie with this ensemble cast, and it was very much a let's take this whole, you know, this whole spaghetti western, or this whole notion of, oh hey, we got the man in the black hat, man in the white hat, and let's just totally throw that crap away and let's kill everyone at the end of the movie. You know, I mean, that's just not something that you do, especially if you do it, it's done rather reverently. It's, you know, it's like he died with honor, whereas these guys just get gunned the fuck down. So, and in Sam Peckinpah, gory nastiness. So it's The Wild Bunch. I've talked about it before. I love it. It's a great movie.
It is a very great movie. I left it off my list because I'm like, you know, I can be blasé about some of these movies and trying to say, no, I like him better than Ethan. No, Ethan's the Peckinpah dude, if there ever was one. Okay, at this point, moving on to my number two. My number two is one that I actually don't believe I've talked about on the show ever before, which is, you know, we've been doing this as long as we have. I mean, there's always going to be a little bit of, overlap. But it actually surprises me because it's a movie that I like a hell of a lot. It's like one of those movies that, I'm honestly, the more I think about it, the more I'm amazed it has never come up on the show, but it's the movie I love, 1968 Roman Polanski flick, Rosemary's Baby. That movie freaks me the fuck out. Just freaks me the fuck out. I mean, it's a good movie. I don't think you don't like it, correct?
I've never seen it.
I can't remember. Oh, you haven't seen it. It's
no.
It's
I know what it's about, but I've just never seen it.
Oh well, yeah. But the thing about this movie, I mean, we can't really appreciate it coming from where we are. We're growing up in the 80s, and we, you know, had the slasher flick, and, you know, we live in a world post Rosemary's Baby and post The Exorcist and things like that. We can't really just understand, you know, just how off-putting some of these movies would have been, you know, after we, you know, dealing with, like, you know, the Universal horror movies and, you know, like that, you know, ooh, boo, that's going to scare you, and, you know, our idea of terrifying and is Bela Lugosi and just stuff like that. And then you have this movie with, you know, it, you know, it's played, you know, just, you know, just serious as a heart attack. You got Mia Farrow, you know, playing, you know, the devil's mother. She becomes pregnant with the devil's baby, raped by the devil's baby, and raped by the devil, impregnated with the devil's child, she's going to give birth to it, and the whole thing going on with with the crazy ass cultist neighbors. Rosemary Clooney is in this one. I believe she won an Oscar for it. It's just one of these movies that's just made of pieces of nightmare. It's a movie that is really good, and I actually just found out Tuesday that there's a Criterion Blu-ray of this. I had no goddamn idea, and I'm like, ooh, that's something that's gonna be on my shelf pretty soon, because I'm very fond of this movie. So I picked it for my number two, and if you have not seen it, Ethan, you definitely should. It's a very good flick.
I think I'll put this in the queue for the Halloween for the big Halloween party. So
yeah, well, I don't know about that, because this is one you need to pay attention to. This isn't this isn't a movie that I'm going to watch and be like, that dog's dead. You know what I mean? This isn't that movie. So, yeah. But it's a good one. It's a very good one. You should definitely check it out.
All right.
All righty. Go ahead. I guess we're on to our number ones.
We are on to my number one. And do you have any idea what my number one is?
No, what is it?
It's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh wow, get the fuck out of here. Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know why. Oh yeah, yeah, I guess that did come out in the '60s. Did not even dawn on me that came out in the '60s.
I know, it's a surprise. It blows your socks off. I'm very predictable, but it's Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. I love this movie. It's Robert Redford and Paul Newman just being awesome on screen for 2 hours, and you have a great story with it's another one of those westerns that sort of turns the whole genre around, and you have, you know, the main characters do die at the end in very similar yet different than the Wild Bunch, but you have it's Robert Redford and it's Paul Newman. I mean, how can you not love Robert Redford and Paul Newman? I mean, these guys created
they're the devil.
Exactly. They raped Mia Farrow. Butch Cassidy Sundance Kid, though, it just is a movie that has this great funness to it. It has the real modern sort of dialogue that goes on in this movie. It's just written well, it's acted well, it's shot well, it's just a well put together piece of cinema. And it's one of those movies that you know, you can sit down, you can watch it, and you're just like, you know, this is just a great movie. This is just wonderful. And it's the best I can do to pull a movie out of the 1960s and say, you know, this is the movie that just does it for me in this decade, and this is it. You have this, you have these great actors doing this great stuff, and it's very much a movie that for me embodies what we were going with that transitional period as far as the 50s into the 70s. Is you have this movie here sort of embodies that for me. Is you have that lightheartedness. It has the elements of the westerns that you've known and loved, but then it also gets sort of into the serious thing and gets into sort of the crazy grit that you had going on in the 70s. So Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, an absolutely fantastic movie that I think everyone should be required to see.
Yep. I mean, it's a fantastic movie. I don't know why it didn't dawn on me. It came out in the 60s, so. I mean, it would have been off put my list any, because why did you get another one? I wouldn't have the balls to try to take from you, because Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is Ethan's movie. I mean, if there ever was an Ethan's movie.
It's a great movie.
But I do think it's funny, though. I mean, we both made our list. We both walked in here saying, you know, like, I didn't know what the fuck to make out of this. But it actually seems like we both came down to westerns. But I went a little bit different route. I went the 1967, Sergio Leone, Good, Bad, and the Ugly. It's a movie I'm obviously very, 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 very fond of. It's a good movie. It's a great movie. Lots of great shit in it. You got Clint fucking Eastwood kicking ass, taking names. You got Eli Wallach. You got fucking Lee Van Cleef. You got, the Ennio Morricone score. You have, wonderful panoramic shots and all that kind of stuff, and this and that, so on and so forth. All those wonderful cinematic sinew, so to speak. And I love this fucking movie. But to me, this movie really kind of feels like the grandfather of the Quentin Tarantino movie. A movie that really takes, like, you know, a long established, you know, familiar concept like the Western, and it does really just turn it on its ear, and it turns it up to 11, so to speak. And you walk in with that really dynamic soundtrack. You have a dirty cowboy, you know, walking in, you know, you have, like, you know, the anti-hero, where it's funny, they're calling him the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I almost wonder, like, you know, how much of that is meant as a joke, saying, yeah, none of these guys are any of those things, you know, because Clint Eastwood is not all good. And, Lee Van Cleef is not all bad. And Eli Wallach is not all, you know, a doofus. And, you know, they're actually all three complex characters. And I guess they, at the end of the movie, in the final gunfight, you know, they do kind of boil themselves down to, like, those basic archetypical characters, but at the same time, that's not who they are in the movies. And it's just really neat that I like all the stuff they did with this. I like that it's such a familiar thing, you know. But Westerns at this point have been all but written off, honestly.
Yeah.
And, you know, they come in and they take this concept, they film it in Italy for $1.87, you know, they inject some freaking, you know, just some dirty into it, and this is the movie we get. And I fucking love this movie. This is one of those movies that, you know, it's always been like one of the first or second, you know, DVDs or Blu-rays or digitals I buy when, you know, I have to switch over to a new format, because this is some reason this is always like one of those first movies that comes out on that. And it's, you know, it's it, I gotta have it. I adore this movie. It's very good. It's my number one favorite movie of the 60s.
Yeah, I know
you've seen this one.
Oh yeah, and it's a
great
movie.
I know you've seen this one.
It's a great movie. It's a great movie. I opted to put Fistful of Dollars on my list rather than that one. Just, I figured you would talk about this one. But Good, Ben, the Ugly is great. I think it's Morricone's absolute best film. It is definitely this. Yeah, it's this. Or Sergio Leone, sorry. Or Ennio Morricone. It is definitely a movie that has, you know, set the standard. It just created this iconic representation of a genre, and it's the good and the bad and the ugly. I mean, just the soundtrack alone still survives today. Everyone knows what that riff is, you know.
It's so dynamic that everybody knows it, but not everyone knows what it comes from.
Yeah,
you'll be all. I mean, it's just that big of a deal.
Yeah, and it's a great movie. You have a lot of great things that happen in that movie, and you know, you don't notice that it's like over 3 hours long. It's great. It's fantastic.
I'm not sure. I realized it was 3 hours long.
Yeah. I've
probably seen it 50 times. So cool, very cool. Okay, so at this point, why don't we run down our list and get ready to stick a fork in this bitch.
Sounds
Ethan,
good.
What's your number 10?
My number 10 is The Birds. My number 9 is one of my absolute favorite movies from when I was a kid, Jason and the Argonauts.
There you go.
My number 8 is A Fistful of Dollars. My number 7 is Psycho. My number 6 is Goldfinger. Number 5 is Goyokin. Number 4 is Yojimbo. Number 3 is Sword in the Stone. Number 2, The Wild Bunch. And number 1, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Excellent. Let's see. Let me bring this thing up. My number 10 is Yojimbo, like I said before. My number 9 is Breakfast at Tiffany's. I really dig that movie. Such a fucking 80s, 60s movie. It isn't funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really talk about this without bringing that up. Then my number 8 is My Fair Lady. My number 7 is From Russia with Love, the James Bond movie. Then I already went over. Number 6, Batman. Number 5, Judgment at Nuremberg. Number 4, Count Us in Hong Kong. Number 3, Psycho. Number 2 is Rosemary's Baby. My number 1 favorite movie of the 1960s is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And bada boom, that is us talking about the films of the 1960s. So, yeah, I mean, it's just like we said. I mean, this is such like, I don't know, to me it almost feels like such a schizophrenic decade. It's hard to nail down, but I do find it interesting that we both did come down to Westerns. Granted, we did come down to very distinctly different Westerns, but it's neat that these are both Westerns from the same decade, and yet they are so greatly varied in, you know, their execution and what they are in terms of movies. So, very cool. Now, before we go, are we going to give out the results of the Pop Culture Movie Showdown, or is that coming out next week?
We can do it this week.
Why don't we do it this week?
Alrighty. Let me load it up.
Load it up.
All right. This probably isn't going to make you very happy, mind you. But
I'm never happy.
Never happy. But round two did close. Round two, we had eight matches going on. And the first match, it was Kikuchio versus Jake and Elwood Blues. Jake and Elwood Blues managed to win over and beat Kikuchio. Kikuchio, of course, being from my favorite film, Seven Samurai. There is that. Then we had...
You're a big fan of the Blues Brothers, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you know, they're great. They're good. And you know, this is what it is. The second matchup we had was two 80s brutal icons, Rambo versus the Terminator. And very decisively, Rambo got terminated. Terminator moves on to the third round. Third match we had was Elvis from
Bubba Hotep.
Yeah, from Bubba Hotep, excuse me. Good old Bruce F. and Campbell. Versus the Mariachi from Mariachi Desperado, Once Upon a Time in the West. Almost as decisively, the Mariachi manages to outplay Elvis. So Mariachi moves on.
Really?
Yes.
Holy shit. Bruce Campbell went out on our Pop Culture Movie Showdown.
I know.
I never would have thought that would ever happen.
All right. The fourth matchup was probably, and this was the closest one we had out of all of these. It was, of course, Tron versus John Matrix from Commando. And it inks it out by one vote. Tron defeats John Matrix from Commando. So Tron moves on to the next round. And the fifth matchup, it was everyone's favorite, Buckaroo Banzai versus Nicholas Angel. Nicholas Angel, of course, being from that awesome movie Hot Fuzz. Buckaroo Banzai, however, ekes it out, wins, and moves on to the next round. The sixth matchup we had was Scott Howard, the Teen Wolf, versus Buffy from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Buffy slew this werewolf rather soundly. So Buffy moves on to the next round.
That's still Christy Swanson Buffy.
So yeah, I know. That's why I'm sort of like, eh, whatever.
Yeah.
And then this is the one that'll piss you off. It's Hans Gruber versus Jason Bourne, and Hans Gruber did lose to Jason
Bourne. Oh, you
gotta
be kidding me. He lost to Jason Bourne?
Yeah, I don't get that.
One of our listeners.
I was totally for... I was totally for Hans Gruber on this one, because really, it's Hans Gruber. Come on. Hans Gruber would just shoot Jason Bourne in the face. Yeah, anyway.
Wow, that's
ridiculous.
Sucks.
But Jason Bourne moves on. And then the last match, it was Connor McLeod versus Ellen Ripley. In a surprise turn of events, Ellen Ripley manages to kill the immortal Connor McLeod. I think she popped off his head with off his head with a power loader. So,
yeah,
the next round, round three, is going to start up, and it's going to be plug these into the randomizer. So when it goes live, you're going to have Buckaroo Banzai versus Tron, the Mariachi versus the Terminator, Ellen Ripley versus Jason Bourne, and then
I hope she kills his.
Yeah, that'd be nice. And Jake and Elwood Blues versus Buffy. So we will see. Really, this year, there's no favorite going in. I guess Buckaroo probably is the going culture, pop culture favorite going into point. So
over Ellen Ripley?
Over Ellen Ripley, over Buffy. But I'm just, you know, since it's the movie Buffy, I'm just sort of like, eh. So, you know, we'll see.
Ellen Ripley. Oh, I mean, I don't know. I don't care anymore. Fucking Hans Gruber lost. I don't care. Yeah. I hope they all die. I hope that nobody. I don't know. That sucks. But Jason Bourne. People like watch those movies. Huh? I'm surprised.
Well, I like those movies, but I totally would have gone for Hans Gruber myself. Just so you know.
Oh well, it happens.
Yeah.
It probably would have helped if I voted. You know. So. There is that. There is that. Okay, well, I guess we'll get that up on the various sites. We'll get that up on the network, and we'll get word out for everybody to go and vote. And I think that's our story, and we're sticking to it with that one. But do we have anything to say before we go goodbye?
I don't think so. My blog is sort of on hold right now until after I get moved and settled. So yeah. This life's too crazy right now. My wonderful wife is graduating. We're recording this on the 24th of April, and she graduates this coming weekend. So we're all proud of her for that. So that'll be awesome. Be on the lookout for her to pop up on the network with a few things. So
very good. Congratulations, Beth. Yeah, we're happy about Beth. You know, my blog, I've been kind of like throwing stuff up on there, you know, here and there, everywhere. You know, I threw up a thing the other day. I don't want to get into it in, you know, too much detail at this point, but our friend of the show, Edward Douglas, has, you know, recently been going through some health issues, and a friend of his threw together a Pay It Forward campaign. It's, you know, it's one of the myriad you know, crowdsourcing different things out there to help him with some of his medical expenses. And so far it's doing very good, because he ended up getting a retweet from both Ryan Johnson, the director of Looper, and he got a retweet from Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg. So he's been getting lots of help there. So he's been kind of overwhelmed by this whole thing and all the support he's getting. But I'll get a link up there on the website for you guys to go and check out, and, you know, maybe throw a couple of bones Ed's way. He's a good guy. He's one of the good ones, and just like to see him just kick the shit out of this thing, and, you know, move on and go back to trashing movies and making everybody mad. So it'll be a good thing. It'll be a good thing. But I guess I don't have anything else. So you, Ethan? No?
Nope. I am spent.
I am spent as well. So I guess until not next week, because next week we're going to be releasing a Lost episode. It's actually going to be an episode of Ed. It's going to be the episode that we recorded the week after the release of the Avengers, where we talked about our favorite of the Marvel movies. It should be a good one. I've listened to it. It actually is a pretty good one, and I have no idea why we didn't release it. So I look forward to that. We kept that. I don't know what we're doing. We'll figure it out by that point, I'm sure. But until that point, I am Aaron.
And I'm Ethan.
That's your geek flag. Bye.
podcast was cut by Uncool Aaron.